Ralph and I were both wondering earlier, how did you find this place?
Rick brought me.
Oh.
After promising to bring me here for months and months and months. I remember, I finally recalled recently, you kept saying to me, yeah, there's this German place you'd like, Doyle went there. And I was going to ask you if you felt like it to offer an anecdote of Doyle and Jacob Wirth. Since I don't think anybody here knows the figure of Bill Doyle in your life and in your pantheon.
Story.
He worked here, right?
Yeah, he worked here for a while. Yeah.
And he was crazy.
He was crazy, yeah.
And one
guy,
time...
Oh, here's a little anecdote about this guy. He was going to become a writer, so he thought to himself that he's a typical dumb Bill Doyle way. But where do all the writers live? Paris, you know? I have to move to Paris. So he moved to Paris and he was allowed so much weight to take on the plane. I don't know, 50 pounds or whatever. And so he took two pairs of underwear, two pairs of socks, a pair of pants, and Baltex collected quartz.
That's a wonderful story.
He's the only guy who can. He was living out in San Francisco and he was working at this comedy club called Boarding House, and he's the only guy I know who could pick a fight and get thrown in jail for beating up Mark Mull, for that comedian.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, pretty mellow comedian. I don't know, crazy character. But anyhow, I knew this place because Bill worked as a waiter. I applied for jobs later.
And what happened during the Paris?
He got real sick. He got a job as a, like a babysitter for a French family. And he lasted a few weeks and he got really sick and decided he had to leave. I don't know what the sickness was all about or anything.
Came back.
So he came back there. He didn't stay over there. He stayed over there about a month. You know. He didn't, you know, become a fabulous playwright he thought he was going to be or whatever.
What do you think? Is it good? You came here with, you know, hardly anything in your pocket. You had a salad, you had chowder, you had a large tuna sandwich, you're drinking beer. Sometimes life provides.
Cool.
Did you say your prayers this morning?
Prayers?
Prayers.
That's why. Ah, the prayers, no.
Well, the prayers,
there you go.
No.
Okay, proceed.
This is a paper about nasal stop sequences. Nasals and stops are two different kinds of consonants. Nasals are so-called because they are produced with air going through the nasal passage. There are two of them, M and N. Try it. N, N, N. Hear the air up here? And these six letters, B, D, G, P, T, K, are called stops because the air stops when you make the consonant. Try it.
Really abrupt.
Now, when you stick them together, you get nasal stop sequences. They can show up in the middle or the ends of words in English and many other languages. What I've discovered about them is that the words in which they appear will mean three different things. Either big and round, like mound, contemptible, like bungler, or impact and or sound, like thump. Okay, off we go. In the first set, big and or round, some nasal stop words clearly mean one thing or the other. Plain big has long, grand, giant, gargantuan, gigantic, and humongous. Round has round itself in many round things. Cylinders, fenders, flanges, thimbles, spindles, candles, rings, and wedding bands, as well as many objects or actions that move along rounded paths. Pendulums, swings, slings, winches, jumping, bempu in Japanese. Bempu?
Chinese?
To jump up.
Jump up is like...
Can you say it? Bemhu?
No, we don't know.
Yeah.
But Bemhu is like Chinese.
But it means that.
I don't know.
I found it in the Japanese dictionary. Anyway.
He's used to gutter Japanese. This is more rare, but...
Could be it. Pendulums, swings, slings, winches, jumping, bounding, lunging, clinging, bending, slumping, winding, and wandering. Abstract size is evoked in ample, plenty, bounty, and idioms like thumping big, womping big, and swinging big. That's a Briticism. The British describe a long time as four yonks. It's opposite we all call temporary. Sizes are measured by pound with its weight in money senses, amount, range, extent, quantity, count, and the word number itself. Plus the important numbers 20, 100, 1,000, and also the sort of slang number umpteen. But the general sense shared by most words in this set is convexity. The mix of size and curvature seen in pumpkins, dumplings, humps, bumps, pimples, mounds, bunches, clumps, bundles, and blimps.
Yeah.
We see it in the landscape too, in mountain ranges and banks of rivers, and perhaps even in ground and countryside. As organic creatures though, we especially delight in inventing words for convex living things, pandas and elephants for instance, trees with their trunks, stumps, branches, and limbs, and other plants with their similarly rounded stems. Mostly, though, we make up words for ourselves. From the ground up, we have convex ankles, shanks, haunches, rumps, flanks, trunks, and tongues in our heads. Birds have wings, and we have hands and fingers, specifically thumbs, index or pointing fingers, ring fingers, and pinkies. Fingers are significant for another reason, too. The linguist Alexis Manister-Raymer has just published evidence that both finger, the word finger, and the Indo-European word for five, that's ancient pre-Latin, pre-Greek, derived from a root pango, which meant fist, in Nostratic, the 12,000-year-old presumed parent language of all of the modern European and Asian languages.
What's it called?
Nostratic. This suggests to me that nasal stop big and round may be among the oldest and most basic pieces of linguistic equipment that we humans have.
Big and round, yeah. That makes sense.
That makes a lot of sense. Yeah.
We are certainly explicit about applying it to our own generative equipment.
Yeah.
Both the female womb and the male dong. Sanskrit calls it lingam. We also apply it to overall judgments about bodies, the roundness and plump, rotund, chunky, paunchy, and thunder thighs, versus the tallness implicit in slender and lanky.
Bang a rump. It's an old Sanskrit phrase.
Bang a rump.
Yeah.
I'll make a note of it.
Pushing for the pushing, man.
We call good looking men hunks, and stereotype good looking women as blondes.
What?
Blondes.
Oh, blondes. Okay, sorry.
Bombshells.
I'm sorry.
And bimbos.
Yeah.
Or even as voluptuous, as a friend of mine persists in saying. She is not alone in inventing a big round word that fits our pattern. Think of King Kong, Rambo, comic book heavies named Mongo, Eddie Murphy's Professor Clump, Humpty Dumpty, circus lions named Simba, Walt Disney's elephant Dumbo, and especially P.T. Barnum's elephant Jumbo, whose very name, of course, has actually become a synonym for big.
So, let's see. I'll try to give you the nickel tour of the first half. Okay, let's see. I'll try the classical Greek way. Story set in Chicago. And it's set in Chicago at the beginning of this year. That's a good way to start. Essentially, it's a Rich America story, so you know those characters. Essentially, his band is on tour. After almost a decade of not being on tour, they're on tour promoting a record. The reason they're on tour promoting a record is because he's decided that he can't get to the next level of metaphysical revelation unless they tour. Unlike most bands that tour because they need bread.
Bands cannot live by bread alone.
Right. So they're in Chicago, and this story essentially takes place pretty much over the course of one day. They've been playing joints there for several months, and Americus didn't really like any of them. But his whole point in touring was that his band members, who are more or less normal musicians, wanted to tour, and so he kind of went along with that. And he had his own kind of cosmic agenda that he wanted to see through. So the first half of this story details a day, the last day he's there. The band is next moving on to play in San Francisco. That's their next city that they're going to play at for a while. The other band members are going to fly, and he's going to take the train. San Francisco, right. So he's separated from them. None of them appear in the story, none of the band members. this is his last day in Chicago, and he hasn't really gotten out of the visit to Chicago what he wanted yet. But he has this last day, and thus far has been detailed him going to the Art Institute of Chicago, looking for something. And he goes there and he writes a lot of poems, and he's pushing himself toward the concept of creating he has a sort of a notion that he wants to write a musical, and that this musical is going to be the story of this poet. But he doesn't have any ideas really. So he goes into the museum, goes to a lot of paintings, and he writes a lot of poetry trying to summon up fibers of this character into being. And so he goes there, and while he's doing all this, he meets a woman whose name is Natasha. And he finds Natasha kind of neat. She's interested in his writing, and she wants to talk to him some more. So they agree to meet in the evening at a bar where they're going to do some more talking. Where the story ended was he leaves the museum, he does his poetry writing, he leaves the museum, he goes to a place called Berghoff's, which is a real Chicago restaurant, which is very similar to this place in many ways. It's dark, has nice wait staff, good beer on tap, good food. Yeah, very nice place. So he sits there and has this kind of reverie, starts talking to himself. There's a drunk guy at the next table who starts talking to him on a different, completely different level. So anyway, that's where the first half of this, that's where I left off about halfway through the story. He's at this restaurant, and it's evening, and he has this date with this woman. She's already said she's engaged to be married, and he's with a woman too, so they're just going to talk. That's the whole point of their interaction. She's in Chicago trying to determine whether she's going to enter a PhD program in art history at the University of Chicago. So she's there for a day. She's there, it's like her last day of her visit, his last day of his visit. They're just like, you know, the Sinatra song, Strangers in the Night, sort of thing. And that's pretty much, that pretty much sums up the first half of the story. Finally, stepping into a joint called Stranger Cafe. His hands steady and his walk sober, his mind is still unhooked, a dozen pressing shoulders. The crowd repels him, but he uses his height to secure a corner table and chair. Waiting, he writes, there must be more to spiritual ecstasy than knowing what to do with candles, during chants, memorizing the words of that book, any one of them, learning to feel devoutness in rhythm with a crowd in a pointed building, if not pointed, then most times odd-looking. Allowing himself to be dipped deeper into the night, Americus loosed something cautious and New Englandly, smiled slightly at the peopled gloom, allowing himself to be observed and charted for this hour. Americus procured from soft hands a hot drink and was now ready to speak, allowing himself a slab of new trust, He encouraged a nose ring, a tattoo, and pink hair to notice his guitar, edge into conversation with him, share tales of making music in Chicagoland, and allowing himself this, playing his guitar here and now, became possible. Music in the air no one advocated, himself suspected to be more than a subway platform Dylan, allowing this without clarifying he wanted to play Beatles songs, and he allowed himself this too, discovering an audience behind the mask of couples and little groups. Encouraged to play a few songs, he allowed something misty to form on the glass as he found himself on the solitary side, black sky and white brights all around him, and he played to people on the other side of the misted glass, allowing himself an unsevered grasp of them. Something floated away. It was him, a winged thing, growing soft and diffused, allowing himself to sink depthless below the misted glass, seeing it way above him as he sank beneath the colored face of creation, and floated a moment on blood, quivering, a bubble now, into the blood of creation, allowing himself to know that our blood creates, we are liquid creating pulses, wondering if he could go back, if he must, what awaited him, allowing himself to know that there is no lasting death in a universe the shape of a thrusting hand. Embrace it all, let it go, embrace it all, let it go. Somewhere up there is the misted glass, allowing himself to recall this. And there are listening jackets and folded hands, and he is playing the music that this far away rings softly but still clear. Oh yeah, all right, are you going to be in my dreams tonight? He holds them like a spoon dipping into soup. He drinks them. They were warm and liquid, floating, now hot and intentional and flowing, and he is drinking them song by song in that dark cavern room on some street in or near downtown Chicago. He is there playing an infinity far here, a bubble in blood. He allows for the uncoupable sense of this. So flung, but he allows, maybe he should go back. It's okay to twist an eternity shower and then return. Okay, Americus? I remember a strange gray hump in a large desolate field, and what all I imagined might live there, and the comfort this gave me as I passed it on Saturday afternoon movie-going days and the unrenewable final dribbles of my adolescence, and a long-gone bookstore near the field, and thoughts I can't remember now as I pass through it. But these things remain alive and real behind the misted glass, down into the quivering blood bubble of creating creation, allowing myself this, something can continue here. America's finishes playing.
And this is a poem about Allen Ginsberg, who, as you all know or not know, died recently.
The late Allen Ginsberg.
Right, okay. All right, so this is called For Ginsberg. Allen, you're all in, alone, at one, releasing queer grasp, scattering words ash on Whitman, Blake, Kerouac, sighing and flying with Naomi. Naomi was his mother. Shedding material odes, changing tantric clothes, masturbating with clouds, winsome and faithful, snapping the sunflower, downloading the Buddha. I saw you once with concertina in fine high transport, squeezing out purple and gold. I wept then, I weep now, through eyes, dick, and viscera, a long sweet caterwaul, for what you were, where you are. There's your star, speeding homeward with the comet, grazing sun, moon, and graveyard, spiraling deep into beaten space, merging with the dirt and light of all the life you've swallowed. This is called Because. Because we just don't remember what it feels like not to be yearning, having arrived here so. Because we just can't forget that death waits in the smallest corners of the biggest skies, change being everything. Because only through pain and loss does reverence quicken. Only when hope departs does hope arrive. Because today is Saturday, there's soup in the cupboard, fat clouds out the window, and stretching our fingers as far as they'll go, we're bound to come up against something. All right, this is called Anger. Fume, burn, boil, rage, attack, passion with the aftertaste of kerosene. your fists through the rooming house wall, your plate in pieces on restaurant floor, your curses igniting the bed sheets. Hello, anger. Essential, dramatic, cathartic, ludicrous. This is called Vessel. It's not only routine we want to dismantle, but drop our humanness altogether and be a piece of jade for a while. Or a coating of dust, unapologetic and still atop a battered dresser. Or perhaps a feather incarnation, the blue rinse of a blue jay first October morning, the stiff beat of a starling lifting lawn to wire, the deft orange step of a gull outrunning ocean wave. Routine in the readings of time pile up in the corners, pile up in the eyes, pile up in the mind, but the blood wants only impermanence, variety, beauty, and calm. This is called At the Shopping Plaza. A mother hands her preschool daughter a pink carnation in a clear plastic collar, and she blushes, accepts, pulls it close. Outside, seagulls screech, nuthouse and free, atop aluminum parking lot poles. Dioramas in all aisles, panoplies in all fronts, an indefinable nausea and hex walking through this mall as a screaming child wriggles in the cart, tired of shopping, tired of buying, tired of getting, tired of sitting in this stupid red seat.
This is from 427.97. Stop chasing Amy the fat field. As hour after hour passes, my impression of this film's greatness grows. I don't think it's about 90% of what those who see it will get. It's about the general amorphousness of identity, not just sexual identity. I tied some of the ideas in this movie with some impressions of Jim Burke's letter in The Cenacle. Then came home to a phone call from Dave, my friend Dave Taylor. How do I explain the amorphousness of my spiritual identity? Okay, this is from 428.97. During the next few days, I want to start an essay on identity, as inspired by Chasing Amy in the Burke letter. It needs to be a personal essay on the amorphousness of my own identity. I also need to clarify in this essay, or another, my ideas about non-progressive spiritual genius, the ability of all to reveal, and the paradox of discipline within spiritual pursuits. What do disciplines do to souls like Burton, Rumi, and Burke? The importance is focus. The more one can focus without structures imposed by others, the more one can do so. Beyond that, discipline should be laid on gently, just enough to maintain focus, not enough so that it becomes a burden to the soul. One thing I need to do is get into how to meditate and begin daily practice. This is where I've kind of railed on and on a bit. Last night, after I finished writing yesterday's entry, I considered the trees and the relationship to the ideas of non-linearity. Like a single tree that rises above the tree line on a hill, the one which catches our attention is the one which rises above all others. Similarly, those who many think of as prophets are those who either will or by will or chance get noticed. The man Jesus becomes a story who fell into the hands of Paul, the great popularizer before that term even existed. Muhammad became a self-great promoter. Other names in each generation pop up. Traveling salvation shows of a given day.
the true contemplative who gets noticed in spite of himself, the Gandhi, the Rasputin, the Martin Luther King, the Jim Jones. In our own society, where the top 10 list can be disposed of in a second, is really more is more readily considered than even the shortest thoughtful review. The ability to get noticed is the standard of all truth. It is seen, therefore it is good. The saint was box office. How many of those would spend a nickel to see it again? I will... Something, worth. should we be surprised that notice and truth should get so confused in matters of the soul? Who sells? Merton or Robert Schuller? Chardin or Deepak Chopra? Hans Kung or Pat Robertson? The point is, the fact that a tree pokes above higher than its neighbors is a measure of nothing that, nothing other than that. It does not measure its ability to shade. The branches may be thin. Its ability to provide fruit. It may be barren. Its ability is firewood. It may be rotten or green inside. But it will get still get noticed. I'm generally optimistic, but I don't see this quality of our culture changing for another 200-300 years. Not until we've had a bit less exuberant over trivialities, a bit more contemplative. By then, Merton, Gandhi, and Chardin may be ready for us.
Okay. That's an old Taoist thought. You know that about the tree?
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, that's an old Taoist thought that the useless tree is the best tree. But the useless tree can grow and rise, and people won't think of it along commercial lines, cutting it down for firewood or for flipping its branches.
Yeah, like that saying, what is the most priceless thing in the world? A dead horse.
Right.
Or a dead cat.
I know that song.
And I'm getting blown away. Much of anything else, but
yeah.
seem to go. How about a peace and love song while I have the time here?
All right, I think we went. The guy just gave us the high sign.
Did he?
Yeah.
Well, we have to.
I suggest we continue to the greatest, oldest, best public park that exists in America, the Boston Common.
Why not?
Yeah. That's the movement. That's the motion. Yeah, the motion to adjourn. Motion to the Boston Common. Second, third, fourth. All right, all right. Does anybody have a second? No, I have a pint. Oh, and I have a bottle. All right, I can recognize kind of the head. Yeah. <laughs> We have a bottle. We have pens, we have blank paper, we have guitars, we have music.
Bobby.
And there's a crispy 7-Eleven thing over there for anybody who wants a
bottle of alcohol. Yeah. Or not. Yeah.
Jim, how'd you like to
play
in the common like yogurt?
The bottle
sounded pretty interesting.
Yeah.
We realize, Ralph, that a linguistic test takes a lot longer than a regular test. You have to, like, squirt out all those bottles and get bones and nasal blockages. All that sort of thing. It's hard. But somebody has to do it.
Right.
Bob.
He's going to try his cigar, Luke.
Those are those Amaretto cigars.
Oh, are they really? Oh,
yeah.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. It's like smoking the soul of a midget dig.
They almost caught
in
fire completely.
Yeah, good thing you shaved your beard. Man, if you hadn't shaved your beard, it'd like be like a three-alarm fire.
That would have been rather
interesting.
Yeah, these things are hard to light. Once you get them, let they stay on fire.
I like this fire up here.
I don't know. Why did you shave? Why did I shave?
Yeah.
Well, I've been meaning to for a while, because I decided that the people at my work were getting used to me in that long, you know, rustic man kind of look.
Right.
See, I do everything in terms of my look for them. I do it to fuck them up, so whatever they expect and are sure of, I do something different. So I'll come in Monday and I'll be completely clean cut. And I'm like, wow, Ray, completely clean cut. What's that mean? What's he gonna do now? I don't know, I just get tired of it. You know, it's a fucking bad thing.
That wasn't your sole motivation, just to see how it affects people's work.
It was part of it, really, the entirety of it. I was also bored with it.
Yeah.
But part of it was that.
Did it take more than one blade to hack through that?
It was just a cheap, you know, bag of 12 plastic ones for a dollar.
Yeah.
Just one.
Just one.
Handful of shaving cream. What you do is you get under it and you scrape it away like long mowing grass.
Right.
You just like a little bit.
It's really quick.
Yeah. Yeah. So does anybody want to get a soda or anything over here?
Whoa. Sorry.
Okay.
actually thought of for you. So Jim, you're on your hill, man. Jim, we brought you to your hill from the old days. You're on your hill. Isn't this your hill? You said, told me this was your hill.
Yeah. Jerry, over to the right about
a little bit of wild turkey to kind of raise your gander and dander.
What troops is that?
Several.
80. I
think we're probably going to.
Anybody?
Wild turkey? Wine or something?
Huh?
I got the wine.
I have to decide what I'm going to have.
I got the wine. There you go. Here's the wine. The cap is slightly out of it, so be careful. Here. I wrote peons to whiskey tonight.
Let's see, what kind of wine is
it? It's Hagasak Rogue.
I like rogue wine.
It's a decent dry red wine.
Oh, god damn.
Well, I think if I have that, I'm going to kill myself.
That pork might be a little bit...
We're going to be a battle for the pork.
Hey, let me get it for you.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, man. Liquid pussy. I'll tell you. That's just my own personal assessment.
All right.
Have a better angle.
And you'll notice that I am not using my hands. No. I'm calling upon the stronger draw muscles.
No, well, I was going to do that, but I...
There. But I've already told Rick
I'm breaking the cork as I draw upon the stronger draw muscles.
Blood is coming.
I love
it.
And I am digging deeper into the very husk of the cork.
I'm bound to be a whiskey drinker in my old age, I'm determined.
And feeling miserably.
Because beer is getting to the point where it's just too much of an old friend.
Which is to use one's taking love was. I was completely rhapsodic when you were reading your piece. I was in heaven.
Yeah.
I really was.
Yeah, he's getting a hard on.
I was getting a metaphysical linguistic hard on.
Yeah.
It was beautiful.
It was. You were walking out there, man. You had a gorgeous smile on your face.
Yeah. I love work.
Yeah.
It shows.
I love to hear, you know, their history and more of their associations, and I love, see, I was thinking as you were reading your piece, all right, here's a guy who's a linguist, and not that I've read a lot of linguists, but when you listen to somebody's work, you determine their predilections, and, you were setting up an analytical case where you were describing these major stars. But you had to make choices. Of all the words that contain those thoughts, you chose certain words.
Right?
And the ones you chose were very, I thought, pertinent to give you the character of who you are. And beneath your spectrum of
experience.
I think you're pretty crazy.
Yeah.
I think crazy in a democratic, you know, I think.
That's good, because I often think, now all these words I choose when I do make examples of different things that they themselves have just gone, what does it tell about me?
It tells a lot.
It must give away a lot.
It does give away a lot, yeah. And I was pleased with what you chose to give away.
Give it all away.
No, I won't give it away.
Thank you.
just a little foggy, but I'd rather have it like this than rainy. They were talking about rain before. That was
I don't think it's foggy.
I forgot
clouds.
My umbrella too.
Rain tomorrow.
Yeah, I heard about that.
I got a guy from the. I had a guy yesterday, Friday. Quarter of five. Now you know how the traffic is.
Yeah, crazy.
I got him from the Fenway, actually Gainsborough Street.
Yeah.
To the airport in 18 minutes.
Wow.
The guy was.
You got him from the back bay to the airport?
No. You know where Huntington and Gainsborough is?
Yeah.
Gainsborough Street.
Yeah.
That's behind, Symphony Hall.
Symphony Hall, yeah.
Storrow Drive was backed up almost to Kimball.
Yeah.
And I got him to the airport in 18 minutes.
Jesus. Wow. That's amazing. How'd you do it?
I told him, I said, listen, it'll cost you about $2 more. So just $2 more, but you'll get, he had to get there. He had to.
Yeah.
He says, can you get me there in 20 minutes?
Yeah. Oh, okay, I see. So he challenged you.
He had to be there.
He had to be there. So it had to happen.
I said, I can get you there. I said, it'll cost you about $2 more. So I went up over the interchange, down a Conk, went down Marlboro Street, I left on Mass Avenue, went over the Mass Ave Bridge, went down Memorial Drive, over the Longfellow Bridge, and the rest is history.
Oh, man.
Well, after I went over the Longfellow Bridge, went down to the Mass General, turned into the Mass General, then took a right, and went around. In between the back road there. Come out by Stanford Street. Went straight down.
Wow.
To the expressway, up and over and out of the
jeez. That's funny. He must have been pleased. He must have been happy.
Oh, it's fucking tickled.